Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 28, 2004. Today's session number is COD 2004-02. Today's speaker is Don Coberly. The lesson for today is Summon Out the Geologist in You. The Laws of Geology. Disregard them at your peril. Let's listen in.
Striations, like they are actually scraped by the glacier?
Yes.
Is that what I'm seeing, rather, would that be prevalent here rather than just striations?
First off, I wouldn't use metamorphic and laminations together. Perhaps looking at a slate, you would talk about laminations. A laminae is the singular. Kind of represents one season or one event, so we think about that being Sagittarius. But the second point, what you are seeing glacially gouging, absolutely, especially if you've been out the 10-mile trail right there where the bench is. And what happens is the ice that is flowing as part of the glacier collects a rock up in it and uses it just like a chisel. And that chisel moves at 3 feet a year, and it's in the ice, and the ice is tough, and you'll just scrape out and cause striations. That's precisely the right word. All right, I have 3:45 on my watch, so if they'll start the tape, I'll start talking. How many people haven't been to either of the two sessions so far? Total newcomers. Okay. My name is Don Coberly. I am a hydrogeologist by training schooling and work, which means I study groundwater. I work in Portland right now. I work for an engineering environmental consulting firm that for the last 7 years has been doing work on the other side of the creek related to the mine. I came here in 1997 for the first time as the person to study the groundwater at the mine site. So I've been doing that for the last 7 years. I've been doing that from 7 years ago till earlier this morning when I was out doing some work related to the mine. I've been on volunteer teaching staff, I think, 3 times. And I've also taught some elder hostel sessions here. So that's my background. This series of sessions is called Summon Out the Geologist in You, which is sort of a play on the summer series of Summoning Out What We Shall Be. And also, it's my thesis and my belief that geology is pretty straightforward and pretty common sense, and anybody, if you've got enough common sense to have been able to get here, you have enough common sense to do geology. So, we've done 2 sessions already. Those were very much talking about basic identification of rocks and rock types and what we might tell from the different 3 main rock types, sedimentary, igneous, and metamorphic. Today and tomorrow, we're going to move into what I call the laws of geology. An analogy that fits for me is if geology is a new language, a foreign language, then the rocks are the words of that language. But the laws of geology are the rules of grammar. If we go out and see rocks in various places, we put them on a map, and now we've got a bunch of rocks types written on a map. Now we use the rules of geology, the basic principles of geology, to try to make sense of those. We'll do that today. We'll recap tomorrow and then spend a fair amount of Friday, tomorrow's Jubilee, nothing serious going on tomorrow. On Friday, we'll look at a bunch of overheads of actual geology in the field, places that I've been and things that I've seen, and relate them back to the things that we've been talking about and we'll talk about today and for part of tomorrow. Saturday is a hike along the 10-mile creek trail and looking at the geology there, looking at the different rock types, and then trying to make a more comprehensive picture of what we see. So, one thing I want to introduce that's kind of off the topic of the laws of geology is the idea of geologic time. The best estimate that I believe in is that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old. That's very old. When I was here, I think it was in either 2000 or 2001, I was trying to come up with a way to sort of make an analogy to this. And because it was, I think it was 2000, I looked back in my history books, and something about 4000 BC is either the first big settlements in civilization or the first writing, first written language. And so at 4000 BC to 2000 AD is 6000 years. So if the thickness of a piece of paper is 6000 years, how much is 4.6 billion years? And if you do 6000 years and you have 500 sheets in a packet of paper, 500 times 6000 is 3 million. 4.6 billion is 4600 million. 4600 divided by 3 is 1,533 packets of paper. So if you go out the front door here, and you set a packet of paper, 500 sheets of paper down, and then you set another one next to it, and next to it, you can stop when you get to the Hike House sign. Okay? Now, I haven't done this personally, but I've figured out the math. So if 6,000 years is represented by the thickness of a piece of paper, then 4.6 billion years is a stack that tall. So, geologic time is a long time. John McPhee, the author, writes of it, and he's written a number of books that have some things to do with geology that are very, very good. I would highly recommend them. He talks about the idea of deep time. And I think that's a very good analogy. That it's really hard for us to conceive of days, weeks, months, lifetimes, generations, just how much time geology has been working. So that's the analogy, or that's the A way that I think about it. So geologic time has been around, geologic time is vast. I don't want to say infinite, but the Earth has been here for a long time. So geologic processes that move very slowly, given enough time, can do very big things. The San Andreas Fault slips at about the same rate that a fingernail grows. That's not a lot. Well, if you grew a fingernail for 3 million years, you could move quite a distance, right? So it's different in geology than it is in any other science, that fourth dimension of time. So I meant to preface that with the reason I was thinking about that was I was looking back through my old teaching session notes from 1999. I had a session titled called, "I Found Some Green Stuff in the Fridge, Do You Want to Eat It?" And the description of the class was, in order to properly evaluate the question posed in the session title, I think you would want to know, one, the age, and two, the composition of the stuff in question. In this session, we will discuss the age and the composition of the Earth and the geologic time scale. So yesterday, we talked for a little while about the composition of the Earth, that it really comes down to eight elements, and now, today, we've talked about the age, so that we've taken care of the two parts of the question that I posed a few years ago. My hope for all of these sessions, and I've repeated it enough times that some people are going to break in and finish it for me, is that I have two ideas. I hope that by talking about basic geology, that rather than doing a big description of Railroad Creek geology and ore mineralogy and some really interesting things that only apply to right here, that if you get excited in doing geology, you're going to go back to Oregon and do the gem trails of Oregon. And so unless it's the same geology that's right here, it's really of no value to you. So what I'm talking about is the larger, broadest scale things that go and apply anywhere. And I've shown these books before, and we had some unsolicited testimony earlier about what good books these are, the Roadside Geology series. They're available for a number of states. I've got the Northwestern states plus Colorado and Arizona because those are the places I've lived. And those are set up as if you're taking a drive from one spot to another, you look up the road and it shows the basic geology along the way and shows some pictures and tells you where to stop and go out and look. So having those exposures of rock and some of the basic concepts that we're about to talk about helps give you an idea, I think it's more of an idea, of what the geology is like. That's one one thing is to give you some concepts to take along with you as you go and read this book, or maybe hear somebody else talk. You come back here next year, and Don Ring, who's a retired professor of geology, comes and gives a talk. You're a little bit ahead of the game. The second thing I want to impress is, again, geology is very common sense. When we start talking about these laws, I think you'll grasp that there's nothing really magical or nothing out of the ordinary about what we're going to talk about. When I was walking back down from the mine site earlier today, I was trying to pose the question in my head, why should you study geology? I mean, I know why I do it, because now I get paid to come here every now and again, and I think that's a really good thing. But what is it for you that should make you curious about studying geology? Why bother? One is simply the intellectual curiosity. I mean, I have a friend, a very good friend, who when we would be out, she would be out standing on the balcony looking at clouds, and the clouds would be prettier when I would be out there standing there with her so that she could share them with me. And coming from the scientific point of view, I'm thinking, no, they're precisely the same as they were before I stepped out the door. But for her, they were better because she could share them with me. My sort of similar peculiarity maybe is I find things more interesting or maybe more beautiful if I can understand how they got to be the way they are. This isn't magic, that this is some set of things that make sense. So that's a personal intellectual. The second thing I could come up with was if you're a homeowner or a property owner and you want to put a well in on your property, there are probably good parts of your property to put a well in on and bad parts of your property to put a well in on. I'm hoping that if you decide you're going to do that, there's some expense involved that you might want to talk to a hydrogeologist first. I can recommend some of those. But that my analogy is then to a medical doctor, if you just go to the medical doctor and listen to everything they say, maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. If you have some background in that or some experience, you can listen to what they're saying and be a better consumer of what it is they're trying to tell you. The same way that if you came to me and said, I want to put a well on my property, I'm going to go do a report and look through the literature and come up with something. The more that you have involved there, the more you can know whether it is I'm trying to blow smoke up, whether I'm trying to fool you and get out of town just after your check clears, right? So I, those are two reasons I can think of why you would do it. I would add the third reason of geology has been a really good career for me, and hydrogeology. So another reason that probably doesn't apply to anybody here is if we were going to do this as a business, and we came into a new area and we wanted to study the geology of that area, how would we go about doing it? And that's the list that's right here. Figure out the geology of an unknown area. Number one, get a base map. And the best base map to use is a USGS, US Geological Society, US Survey topographic map. Is anybody not familiar with the topographic map? Has lines of equal elevation on it. You can tell where the mountains are, where the streams are. So this would be what I would use as a base map if I were going to do geologic mapping in this area. Go ahead.
I want to add another reason on your list.
Okay.
I want to find, as a rock hound, I want to be efficient in finding the various kinds of stones that I'm going to work out for jewelry or specimens or whatever.
Precisely. That's another good reason. I was going to go into a long, convoluted explanation of in Wisconsin, in some of the glacial material, they found some diamonds. And either they got there by some extraordinary way, or else somewhere along the path of that glacier, there is a source of those diamonds. And so if you wanted to study a lot of geology, and particularly glacial geology, and be able to map that back and find the source area, like we talked about in earlier days on the sedimentary rocks, and could come across where these diamonds were from, then you could get the mineral lease for the property, open it up, mine diamonds, get really rich, and remember where you got the idea from. In the meantime, if we're talking about doing the geology of an unknown area, the first thing we do would be get our base map. The second thing we would do would be hike around, look at rocks, put rock outcrops on the map. This is sort of what we'll do on Saturday on the hike. We'll locate ourselves on the map, we'll put a little X on the map and say, here's the rock type we see at this place. And we'll hike a little farther and we'll put another X, and if it's the same rock, we'll write same, and if it's a different rock, we'll write different. And we'll have that, and at the end of some days of hiking, we'll have a map with a bunch of points on it, and now we need to start making sense of where those rocks are. If all the rocks here were completely flat-lying, we'd be on this side of the creek and we'd find a certain type of rock, and we'd jump over on the other side of the creek and we'd find a certain type of rock, and as we go down valley, we'd get to another place and it'd be the same on both sides but different than it was above. And this is layer cake geology, kind of like the top part of the Grand Canyon, and it's really simple geology. That's not the case here, so that if we go on the other side of the creek, we'll find something different. And now we need to start being able to make sense of this. And this is where, what do I say, figure out relationship in space of rock units. That's where these rules are going to help us. The fourth thing is that I say here is finish the map. The fifth thing I talk about is describe the geologic history. Once we have a bunch of rock units on the map, and we know what kind they are, and we know how they fit together, now we start writing a history of how did they get here. And then six there, as an addendum, would either be get your master's degree or get paid, depending on what the project was that you were doing. There is a geologic map of this area. It was done, I assume, precisely following those steps that we just talked about. And the map has two components. This is a USGS topo base with the various rock types plotted on it as they would be as if we were flying over this in an airplane, a map view, a couple of cross sections that show the third dimension, and then a description of all the various rock units. And by convention, based on the age of the rock unit, we give it a different color, and by the rock type, we give it a different pattern. And now you can look at the map and knowing a little bit about the naming of the rocks, that the different geologic ages you can sit down and do some work here. Now, knowing where the ore body is on this side of the creek, if we decide, hey, maybe there's some more copper on the other side of the creek, we can go line up there and we can go walk and we go see where it is and we can dig a test pit and see whether there's any more ore there. So, what do we use? What are the rules that we use? Once we've got all our rocks on the map, and this thing is really an iterative process. At the end of one day of going and looking at rocks, we would start developing hypotheses. If we saw everything that was all the way along our hike, and we were always at the same elevation, and we saw all the same rock type, we'd think, well, maybe this is a horizontal line unit. If we came across units, one after another, we would measure the contacts between those units and we would write down those boundaries. We'd come back on the bottom part of the trail and find that same boundary, and now we got two points on the line and we can draw a line in. We draw it in solid between the two points and then kind of dash it as we went away to say maybe it still goes there, maybe it doesn't. We start hypothesizing, we come around, we've got other friends who are doing the same thing, we sit around with a cup of coffee after work and we start brainstorming, coming up with ideas. Some of, you know, I've got a really good idea, I think it fits the data. Somebody goes, well, what you forgot to think about was this, and he blows my idea out of the water, and now we go on to the next hypothesis. These things are, I've called the laws of geology mainly to make them sound really important. I have a set of handouts to give you if you would like to keep them, or for you to use today, and then give back to me. That help further illuminate these laws. And go ahead. Do you have a question?
The map that shows the rocks.
Yes.
The regions.
Yes.
USGS does that as a public service. Just
yes.
For information, and how much the United States?
I don't know. I suppose on the USGS website they may have some. I would I would go in, they have state size maps, and then you can go in from there to the quads. Those are based off the quadrangles, and you should be able to find fairly rapidly whether the quadrangle you're interested in has a geologic map done for it or not. Okay, the other thing about these laws of geology, in my ongoing browbeating of geology being fairly simple and straightforward, there aren't a whole lot of them. There's one principle and four laws. The first principle is the principle called uniformitarianism. And to make it sound even more official, I want to read the definition out of this dictionary of geological terms. Uniformitarianism, the fundamental principle that geological processes and natural laws now operating to modify the Earth's crust have acted in much the same manner and with reasonably the same intensity throughout geologic time, and that past geologic events can be explained by forces observable today. The classical concept that the present is the key to the past. The doctrine does not imply that all change is at a uniform rate and does not exclude minor local catastrophes. The summary of that is simply the present is the key to the past. And that first picture that you have, the first page that you have, has two pictures on it. One on the left is a 3.5 billion year old rock that has these concentric circles in it. And the other, and a photo taken 5 years ago up in the mountains in Bolivia of a hot pot that shows precisely the same thing. And this is the essence of the principle of uniformitarianism, that what we see now can help us figure out what happened in the past. Gravity has always worked in a downward direction. Water didn't used to flow up. It's always flowed down. The principles that we see, the things that we see in place today. Railroad Creek is flowing right now. Water in the past wasn't tremendously thicker than it is now, or more viscous, or could move bigger stuff. So we see Railroad Creek today, and we look out and we say, oh, there's the size of the particles, the boulders in Railroad Creek. And now we go someplace and we find a deposit that looks just like that, and it's 2 billion years old. We're still going to make the analogy that, okay, that was a Railroad Creek-sized stream. It wasn't tremendously bigger, tremendously smaller, because there was some different physical property operating. Does that make sense? It makes perfect sense to me. That's the principle of uniformitarianism. It's sort of the overarching law of geology. The second part of that definition, or the second part that I read in that definition was, that doesn't mean that every day of the last 4.6 billion years has been precisely the same. There are, you know, there was a flood here last October that probably did more geologic work in that one day than has been done every day since then put together. It's not that everything is day after day the same way. It's over the large scale of time, things are about the same, and we don't need, there are no different processes at work today than there have been in the past. Now, my caveat to that is, I don't know that that holds for the last 4.6 billion years, because for about the oldest rocks that we can find are, I think, 3.8 billion years old. So there's 8.8 billion years, 800 million years of time that we don't really have a good record for. We assume that for the majority of that time, the surface of the planet was molten. And so I don't know, that's a personal, I don't know why I'm going to say bias, but a personal, an additional caveat to write for that, that we don't know for that first 0.8 billion years, but we do know for the last 3.6 billion years, and that's a lot of time. So that's the principle of uniformitarianism. The second is the law of original horizontality. That was obviously coined after a big board meeting. What that means is rocks get laid down flat, particularly sedimentary rocks, which we said on Monday and a little bit yesterday, comprise about 70% of the rocks that we see and can get to at the Earth's surface are sedimentary rocks. They're created by water or solid particles being moved by fluids. And obviously those particles get dropped out under the force of gravity, and so it lays things down flat. We talked about the extrusive igneous rocks, sort of Hawaiian volcano style stuff, and that gets laid down flat as well. Where it kind of falls apart is when you talk about more volcanic rocks, Mount Hood volcano or Mount St. Helens volcano or Indonesian volcano, that stuff stands up pretty high. But in the grand scheme of things, that doesn't comprise a real big part of the planet. So for the majority of the planet, this law of original horizontality holds. Now, of itself, I don't find that to be a particularly illuminating idea. It's real straightforward, but it doesn't help us very much. Where it comes into play is if you find rocks that are stood up on end, that's not the way they got laid down. So you need to invoke some method that got them from flat to not flat. They didn't get, if you find a bunch of rocks that are stood up on end, that's not the way they were laid down, right? You just can't stack up a pebble on top of a pebble on top of a pebble on top of a pebble. The erosive forces of the planet will take care of that pretty quickly. So it got laid down flat, it's not flat anymore. There has to be some reason why it's not flat. That's the law of original horizontality. The third law is the law of superposition. Reading once again from the Dictionary of Geological Terms, just to make it sound important. The law of superposition. A general law upon which all geologic chronology is based. In any sequence of sedimentary strata or of extrusive igneous rocks that has not been overturned, the youngest stratum is at the top and the oldest is at the base. Each bed is younger than the bed beneath it, but older than the bed above it. The oldest rocks are on the bottom. The younger rocks get laid down on top of it. Anything incredibly complicated about that? Anything not really intuitive about the law of original, law of superposition?
What about volcanic rock that rises from below?
That's igneous, intrusive igneous rock, and that is one place, it said in here where it talks about sedimentary rocks and extrusive igneous rocks. I think when you get intrusions, now you have to look at other things to help, and that's where we're headed in these next couple of laws, is what do we do in that circumstance? But if you have a set of sedimentary beds, they're oldest on the bottom and they're youngest on the top. The only way that that would be different is if for some reason the whole package got turned upside down. One thing to add to sort of your general thinking about geology that we'll use here a little bit more in a while, I mean, we could suppose that a unit got laid down and another unit got laid down, and then somehow and two more units got laid down, and then somehow those top two units got picked up and another one got slid in the middle. I suppose it's feasible. I mean, we could draw it up. Go ahead.
I understand from reading that the Glacier Park Rocky Mountains are overthrusted mountains.
Yes.
Something like you're talking about.
Yes.
The old rock on top of young rock. So
yep.
We have an example not too many miles from us of this.
Absolutely. That's the next. We're going to get there in about 2 minutes. Which way is up? That's a very good question. And that throws the whole deal out. Where I was headed was we have these layers that get laid down, and then somehow we pick up two of them and we slide another layer in. I mean, it's feasible. In geology, we sort of think of the simplest explanation, try to come up with the simplest explanation being best. This is a stealing of a philosophical argument called Occam's razor, that when numerous hypotheses are advanced, the simplest one should be favored. And so I don't know how old that is, 1500 or 1600, something like that. In geology, down at the University of Arizona, they call that the principle of least astonishment. So if you have to come up with either a really simple explanation or an astonishing explanation, let's try the simple one first. You have in your pictures, and I have a handout that looks at this principle of superposition, which is the candle wax on the plate handout. And this to me is a very good analogy of, say, if you were going to Hawaii and you wanted to see a series of volcanic flows and try to figure out which one's the youngest and which one's the oldest. And so this is the second version of this I've done, and I'm still not satisfied with it. So if you come back next year or the year after, I'll have a better set of candle pictures to show you. But we have, I think, three different colors of candle wax here, or if you want to make them be volcanic flows, you can make them be that too. Which is the oldest and which is the youngest? My guess is that the red one is the youngest, since we can still see the candle there. Some people would think that cheating, but I think that's using all of the clues that were given. And so now the question becomes, is the black or dark green stuff older or younger than the yellow stuff? And my looking at it is that it's the oldest. I think I see places where the yellow has come over the black, like right here, there's a lobe of the black stuff with a lobe of the yellow stuff sitting right on top of it, right? So either the black stuff's the old stuff, and the yellow stuff flowed on top of it, or the yellow stuff was there and the black stuff flowed underneath it. And I like that first idea better. We think the red is the oldest, is the youngest, excuse me, the most recent. I don't see any information here that sort of controverts that. Here there's red stuff sitting on black, that's still okay. There maybe none of that yellow candle came over this way. So if we were looking, you know, the order to me is black is the oldest, yellow's in the middle, and red is the youngest, the last candle burnt. Does that make sense? So that if you were in Hawaii and tracing these flows and could come up with some characteristic of the flow that was a little bit different, it had more gas bubbles in it, or it had a little bit different chemical composition, or because it had more iron in it, it was starting to rust, you could, it would be red colored and you could trace it along. Now you can tell qualitatively which is old and which is young. We can't add any specific dates to this yet, but we can tell which are the old things and which are the young things. Go ahead.
Dumb question, but I don't know much about candle making.
Okay.
But when you make candles, does, would the red be poured in first or last? I'm thinking about old and new now. Which is the oldest, which is the new?
I'm not following your question.
You're talking about striking candles?
No, I'm talking about that particular candle right there. Which when you're making a candle, which comes first? Does the top of the candle come first, or is it the last part that you put in there?
Oh, well, if you were burning a candle, that would be a different thing. In this case, I burned three different of those small, votive candles.
Okay.
Just to, so if it were, I'd have to think about it. That's too confusing. Because that would mean the black was at the top of the candle, and you burned it and it flowed down first, and then you ran out of all the black, and that. So that, thank you. Next time I give this talk, I'll make that caveat as well.
Yeah.
The big hitch in the giddy-up that was highlighted here is which way is up. Is it possible that this entire package has somehow gotten turned over? Well, is it possible? Yeah. Big deal, Don. It can happen, but it doesn't happen very often. Well, the closest place to right here that it's happened is right there. The Holden ore body is an overturned bed of rock. So this is not in the Alps and the western United States. When you get really highly compressive forces, you can bend rocks to where they're overturned. How is it possible that you can take something that's a rock and bend it so much that it overturns? It's like a piece of carpet. I wish I had a piece of carpet here, but here you're bending and you're bending and you're bending and you're bending, and all of a sudden you've gotten to this point. And these rocks right here in the middle are overturned, right? Well, that's a kind of a hard task. Is glass a solid or a liquid?
Yes.
That's exactly the right answer. Glass is both a solid and a liquid. Glass is what I think of as being an incredibly viscous liquid. It's very, very thick. What's been reported, I haven't been there to see this personally, but is if you go to England and go to the churches there, the window panes are thicker at the bottom than they are at the top. And that glass has been flowing slowly downward over the last 600 years under the force of gravity. Because now, is it viscous enough that when you throw a rock through it, it deforms around the rock? No, it breaks. Again, when we're talking about bolt bending and folding rocks, we're talking about things happening over millions of years or tens of millions of years or hundreds of millions of years. And under that time frame, and with a little bit of heating, rock becomes a little bit ductile and you can bend it that way. And next in your list of handouts, I believe, is something from the American Geological Institute called Criteria for Determining Top and Bottom of Beds. If you can figure out where the top of a bed or some beds are, you can know whether your entire section is right side up or upside down. The first thing it talks about is tracing beds. We've done enough geology that we can find a unit and we know how it looks in space, and we find one unit on top of the other, and we get to some place, and all of a sudden, what used to be on top is now on bottom and the other way around. Well, now we have some evidence that that bed has been overturned. And I don't know if this is in your set, is it? This is a sketch. Tightly folded and overturned sedimentary rocks in the European Alps from R. Trumpy, 1960. So he went out and was looking at the Alps and did this sketch, and there's a unit that I've sort of darkened in a little bit more that is right side up, I assume, all the way through here, and it gets to this point and gets overturned. So right in there, you would find the beds over, and now the younger rocks, let me think about this, you do a cross section right through here, you would find oldest on top and youngest on the bottom, as you go through that, the heart of that curve. And then the geology gets so messed up that even he can't trace it very well. So that's the kind of place that I had to do field camp, was right in there.
If you only took one sample, then you might have a wrong conclusion.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, tracing of beds in recognition are normal sequence. The second thing is looking for scouring or channeling. If you have a series of horizontal beds that have somehow been gouged into, the thinking is that set of beds is in their right sequence, in the right orientation. And the note that I've made here is turn over and see if it makes more sense. This is going back to the principle of least astonishment. If you have a set of rocks and you look at it that way and go, well, yeah, maybe it makes sense, maybe it doesn't, just turn the whole thing over. And now what we have is this series of bumps that then have a bunch of stuff laid down on top of it, and then another bump. Well, the planet tries to take care of bumps, right? Erosion, if these things can't be maintained very long at all, anything that sticks up around the surrounding terrain is going to get worn off by wind or water or whatever. So the thinking is that's more likely. Here's a picture where we have, here's a bluff with the ground surface. Here's one kind of material that looks all reasonably the same. Here is a divot into it that's filled in with something else. So we look at it and we go, well, gosh, this sure looks right way up. Let's flip the whole thing over and see if it makes any more sense to us that way. It's possible I got to think about how this would work, that this was all part of a package that then all got overturned and then this stuff got eroded off, right? Go ahead.
It would make some difference what kind of material you're talking about too, though. I mean, if your bump is a piece of basalt and you've got something like pumice or volcanic ash on top of it, this makes more sense.
You're right. Absolutely. What is in there, think about precisely what you just said. If this were somehow more resistant material and this were less resistant, that might make some sense. In this case, we go and we would bang on this stuff and we would find out that this is a coral reef. And we would dig around in this stuff and find out that it's silt or clay-sized stuff. And now what seems reasonable to me is that there was something that eroded through that coral reef that there used to be a stream in there that has since been abandoned, and that's the material left from there. But that's an excellent point. We're trying to be as simplistic as we can in the moment, but if that stuff that's there is the hardest stuff you can find anywhere, then maybe it's true. Maybe it happened.
Except if you go to Turkey where you have the chimneys, the hard part is on top.
Okay.
Like little halves on stovepipes.
Okay. What, and that's a great point. I appreciate that. No one's raised that in four or five versions of this. What's next on the list? I gotta find that sheet. Here we go. It talks about conglomerates. The point is, if you have a set of layers that have been laid down and then you come into a new layer and some of that material has been incorporated, again, either this stuff was laid down first and now a stream came along and gouged up some of that and incorporated it like Railroad Creek might do, and then the stream went away and now that all that material's been deposited. Again, the flip side of that is somehow there's a bunch of material that's in here. This might be a place in a cavern, if we're going to use alternative hypotheses, that might happen, that this material might fall down from the roof. But in general, having material fall down from above into a lower unit, we don't see that happening very much. So we go back to the simpler explanation. And so if we find this situation, our guess will be this package is right side up. Solution surfaces. This is what we might find in Kentucky Limestone Cave, Missouri area, where I've done some work. You have a real rough surface that you see. We would see something like this in a road cut if we were driving along, and we would find a rock with these jagged holes in it and then some other new kind of rock on top of it. Again, we do the mental thing in our mind. Let's flip it over and see, do we believe that at some point in the past there were these, I don't know what you would call them, that stuck up above the general surface and were maintained for some long period of time, and then more material was deposited on top of it. Again, if this is the hardest stuff here and this stuff were softer, maybe we want to revisit that, or we write it in our book and say we're still questioning this and we go and look for more information. The last one of these we'll look at is a thing called graded bedding. When Railroad Creek had the big flood back in October, I assume that out at the mouth there was just this big whoosh of stuff that came out. All the material that's been transported by this really high flow gets blobbed out at the mouth of Railroad Creek, and then things start to settle out. Well, the biggest stuff would settle out first under the force of gravity, and additional material that's lighter might take a while longer to settle out. So you would find big material at the bottom getting, it's called fining upwards, so you have cobbles and boulders at the bottom and then sand and then silt and then clay. So if you see that in a cross section, you have a good idea that direction, that the thing is still the way it was originally, that it's right side, right way up is the way we're talking about. There's a whole other page of additional clues, and again, this AGI book that this was taken out of is just sort of a whole little notebook full of cheat sheets on different parts of geology that I find real useful when I'm out in the field. And I don't do that much geologic mapping, but I think the guys who do even more than I do have this stuff with them all the time. And as they're out walking, the one that we'll look at here is if you have a series of mud cracks on a surface, right? There's a mud bar. What am I talking about? It's like a sandbar, and it's got mud on top of it, and then it gets stranded, and that mud starts to dry out, and you get these cracks, and the little pieces dry out and pull apart, and now you've got space between them. When you see that again, let's do the opposite. Let's look at it this way and say somehow we had this material, you know, this is, now this is, we're thinking this is right side up. we had this material, and somehow these little concave down pieces flecked off and dropped into it, and then some of this first material got pushed up in there. That's not the simplest explanation. So that's just a list of things that you would take in the field with you, I would take in the field with me, and we would go, we would see these road cuts and we would make some estimation. We'd say, oh, well, this whole package is right side up. Or alternatively, it's upside down. Any questions? Next, the law of inclusions. And then as sort of an add-on to that, baked zones and chilled margins. Someone was talking yesterday about a xenolith, which is a piece of material that gets cut up or gets caught up if you have a rock that has a fracture in it, and now you jet some molten material into that fracture. Every now and again, that stuff, because of the force of the injection or the heat or both, will shear off a bit of the rock that was already there and incorporate it. The idea being that rock that is incorporated is necessarily older rock. The other, the more complicated solution is somehow you had this rock layer and now you put two rock layers in on top and bottom of it, and somehow you got some of this second rock layer into the middle of the first rock layer. That's a harder sell, right? I don't make as much sense as the first hypothesis, which is you had the rock that was here and you jammed something into it and it sheared a piece off. So that inclusion is necessarily older than the stuff it's included in. Is that pretty common sense? I think it is. I have it. The next thing I have is a page from my field book in 1981, when I was at field camp. And since I can't draw to save my life, this is really kind of confusing. But what this is would be if we had a rock face right here and we dug a bunch of backhoe buckets into it and made vertical walls on both sides and one in the front, so that then you could go in and look at it. And so here's the two sides and here's the back face and here's the place where you can walk in and you can look at this material on two sides. Actually, it was on three sides of the cut. Okay? Does that make sense? And so, what I write is a dike of KG. K is an age, K means Cretaceous, it's an age designation for this unit. G was for granite, a certain kind of igneous rock. Dike of KG cuts through main body of KQM. So we also know it's Cretaceous, QM is quartz monzonite, which is another kind of igneous rock. A chill zone is present in the dike. So as this dike, hot dike, got injected, right at the edges, it's up against cold rock that's already in place. So it cools more rapidly. We talked yesterday about the different, one of the ideas in our extrusive rocks is that the crystal size is related to how quickly it cooled. So in the middle part of the dike, you have a little bit of hot dike next to another part of hot dike, it's going to cool more slowly, whereas at the fringes, it's going to cool more rapidly. The crystals are going to be smaller at the edges than they're going to be in the middle. That's what we call that, a chill zone. Faster cooling leads to finer grain. Well, I knew that 20 years ago. A bake zone occurs in the surrounding wall rock. Again, you have this rock that's there minding its own business, and all of a sudden you jet this hot stuff in. It sort of reheats the edges a little bit and causes a little bit of recrystallization right there. A bake zone occurs in the surrounding wall rock. The recrystallization seems to make the parent rock darker. So somehow by that reheating, there was a little bit of segregation of the darker minerals closer to the edge. A xenolith of the KQM is present. So what I know after having been in that little cut is that the KQM is older. Right? That's the way you get the xenolith inside the new material. So when I write my geologic map, I better have KQM down below where I have KG, or I've got a bad map. Make sense? That's the law of inclusions, and I talked a little bit about bake zone and chill margins. The last thing to talk about is the law of cross-cutting relationships, the last of the big laws of geology. And I need to do a... demonstration, that's what the word I was trying to find, of the law of cross-cutting relationships. Now say I've been next door in the drawing class and I've suddenly decided that I'm not going to do geology anymore and what I really want to do is art. But not so much like drawing art, it's sort of more free-form, new age, new wave art. And I'm going to start with a blank slate here on my piece of paper. I'm going to start with a piece of tape. Could you help unfold that tape? Because I can't do it. Save my life. And I got this green tape, and I think I want to do something like that. And I like that a lot. And now we're. This is sort of the hopelessness of our current situation. And then I want to add something that sort of offsets it a little bit and gives it a little more balance. I think I like that. But I think it needs some red. And so what I really kind of want to do is that. But, you know, I don't think it fits in the frame that I want to use. And I had some scissors here a little bit ago that I need. Now, don't try this at home. I'm a professional. Where are my scissors? Oh, wait a minute. There we go.
May look better in the blindness.
Yeah. And then, I think, and having it this way, it's just not, I don't like it as much as I thought I was going to. So, could you help me for just a second? And put that back up there. And, okay. Thanks very much. I'm going to grab these. Oh! This happens every time. Don't worry. We're fine in here.
Reverse avalanche.
That's right. I meant to do that. There's no need for the people to go call. And you know, I want to save this so that 10 years from now, when we're all back together here, I'm gonna save this right now, and I'm going to put it in an envelope, and I'm going to go put it in the hole and safe, which doesn't really exist, but let's pretend that it does. And we all come back 10 years from now, and we have this session again, and I go, you know, somebody opens the safe, and we bring it back down here, and you'll remember this? And you'll, and we say, I'm trying to remember, how did you do that? You know, we want to have one for our house. How did you do that? And I'll say, well, I put the green tape down first, and then I put the masking tape on top of that. Then I drew the red line, and then I cut it and taped it with the clear tape. You guys go, man, that was 10 years ago. How do you remember that? That's amazing. And I'll say, no, it's not amazing. It's I know the law of cross-cutting relationships. I'm a geologist. And the whole point of all this stupid fooling around is younger events cut older events. What was the oldest event in my horrific art project here? It was the green tape. How many things cut the green tape? Well, we can see right here that the masking tape is younger, it's on top. We can tell that the red stuff is younger, it's on top. We can tell that this cutting, we can pretend that's a fault, cuts it, so it's younger. So we know that the green thing is the oldest thing there. Looking next, the masking tape is the second oldest thing because it gets cut by the red line. You can see the red line drawn on top, and it gets cut by the scissors cut. But it's younger than the green tape because it's on top of it. we can look at the red line and we can see that it lays on top of the green and it lays on top of the white, but it got cut by the sock, the scissors cut. So, younger events cut older events. Is there anything magical about that? Let's take that idea into the geology realm. And here's a block diagram that might represent some little corner of the world. And what we have here is, if you scoot these two blocks back to their original position, we had three different layers of material laid down, this unit one, unit two, and unit three. And then apparently a fault offsets them. Do we know the ages of each of the units? We can guess that these, in this block diagram, we can guess that these units, one, two, and three, are sedimentary units. So we can use our law of superposition. As long as the whole thing isn't overturned, and we don't have any evidence here to say one way or the other, but if we make the decision that these are right side up, one is the oldest event, two is the second oldest event, third is the third oldest event, and four, the fault, is the most recent event because it cuts each of the units. In this case, after some more time, we have another unit that gets deposited on top of it, and so with this now being unit four, we can call our fault sort of event 3.5, right? It's after event 3 but before event 4 because the fault doesn't cut that unit. Anything complicated about that at all? What you have in the remainder of your handouts is at first a set of sort of more increasingly difficult, you know, that was the crossword puzzle with all the three-letter words. Now we moved on to the crossword puzzle with the four and five-letter words. Let's look at this first block diagram. And again, we're going to make this guess that these are sedimentary units, and they've been laid down, one, two, three, four. We know that those are older than this dike, if that's what we want to call it, because it cuts all those units. We make the guess that event 5 is younger than the dike. For one thing, the dike doesn't cut it, and for the second thing, we see these pieces of the dike that have been incorporated. And if this was all a set of units that were laid down, and then there was maybe a little bit more of unit 4 on top of it, and this dike came in, and now unit 5 is some stream unit, a stream deposited by a stream, as it washes across that dike, it may pick up pieces of it and incorporate it into the sediment, right? Let's do one more. We have a series, and this talks about the intrusive, who mentioned about the intrusive, the igneous rocks, how does that fit into this dating scheme? Here's a series of units, sedimentary units, that got laid down flat, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Somewhere in that, well, after, my guess is after unit 4, this intrusion came in because it breaks all the way through unit 4, but doesn't break through unit 5, so it's younger than these units. Where it is in relation to particularly unit 6, we can't make any estimation. It's possible that all six of these units were laid down first, and the intrusion only got up through the first four of them, right? We can't make any estimate as to how that relates. We have a dike in here that we think is younger than the pluton, than the bigger gob, because it cuts the bigger gob, right? So as we go out in the field, this is one of the things that we'll look at, and particularly with faults, what we'll see is, if we can find them, and we can find a number of them, we may find faults. Generally, what we'll see in an area is that the faults kind of line up generally. It's not like faults radiate in all different directions. Faults are generated by larger tectonic forces that are sort of pushing in one direction. So So we might see on the map a number of faults that run in a certain direction. What we, another thing that we'll see sometimes is a second set that offsets the first batch. And we'll see another one like that down here. And we, what we'll write in our field book is that these northwest, if this is due north to the top of the map, that our northwest trending faults seem to be younger than the northeast trending faults, right? Because they're younger, they cut. So I think, since I have a minute and 15 seconds left, that this is a good place to stop. What you have in the rest of your package is more complicated versions of what we've just been talking about. And then the same sorts of topics, the cross-cutting relationships idea, and those clues that we've been talking about from another source, just out of another book. Sometimes I hear things from said one way and I don't get them. I hear them say it, heard the same thing another way, and it makes a lot more sense. So in this packet, if you want to take it with you, there are sort of multiple sources of the same thing, and maybe one will make more sense than the other. So that's the session for today. Tomorrow, we'll do a blazing fast recap of this and then look at some actual geology overheads and slides and talk about these concepts as how they relate in the real world rather than on block diagrams or goofy art projects.
You mean Friday?
Friday.
What time?
Friday is 5:05.
Here?
Yes. And I'm also doing a 7:30 a.m. session on precisely the same thing. So 7:30 a.m. if you're early riser and function well then, or 5:05 if you don't.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.